This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There are several ways you may know my guest, Jonathan Pryce. If you like Bond films, you'll recognize him as the villain in Tomorrow Never Dies. If you like Mamet, you'll know Pryce as a gullible customer in the film adaptation of Glengarry Glen Ross. Pryce won a Tony for his portrayal as a repellent pimp in Miss Saigon. He starred in the cable movie Barbarians at the Gate, but TV viewers may know him best for his Infinity car commercials. Pryce's other films include Brazil, Carrington, and Evita. Now Pryce is starring in a revival of My Fair Lady in London's West End, and he plays composer and conductor Gustav Mahler in the new film Bride of the Wind. The film revolves around musician Alma Mahler and her tumultuous relationship with Gustav and several other brilliant men, including the architect Walter Gropius and the novelist Franz Werfel. I asked Jonathan Pryce what he needed to know about Gustav Mahler before portraying him.
What I've found when I've played kind of biographical roles in the past is that there's a danger of having too much knowledge, and because ultimately all you have is the script, and that's all the audience are going to receive. But there's a lot to read about Mahler, a lot to find out about him. And he was a hugely complex character, but sadly, not for the film, but sadly for me, it's one episode in the film. The film is essentially about Alma Mahler and her life and lives with the various men in her life. And Mahler takes up the first part of the film. I would love to have gone on. I'd love the film to be called Gustav or something. Bridegroom of the Wind. And gone on to explore in depth, you know, much more about Mahler. I mean, because there are so many things that are just hinted at and dismissed in a sentence or so. You get the information over and then you move on. And it's essentially about his emotional life with Alma. There's another film there that I'd like to make.
You have a love scene with Sarah Winter, who plays Alma Mahler. This is before she's married to Mahler. Mm-hmm. But I think this love scene is a good example of how something in movie love scenes has shifted. Now, you're both under the blankets in this, so we don't get to see your bodies, but we can see by your movements that you're actually having, or I mean, the characters are having sexual intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
You could just tell that from the motions. What do you think of having to do that in love scenes now? I've seen this a lot in movies now. You know what I mean? That kind of like up and down motion. You could tell what's supposed to be happening.
Oh, that thing.
Yes.
The up and down thing.
The up and down thing, yes.
Well, it was in... It's very integral to the scene and very important. I don't know how to talk about it, other than saying the scene is written in a way that Mahler, the first part of the lovemaking scene, he's incapable of, or is shown to have been incapable of making love to her. And it tells you something about his character and his personality. And then in the second half of the scene, when Alma takes control, then they're able to make love, and that's really what it's about, is about being able to... The second part of the scene is about being able to fulfil it. I think the way we did it was rather tasteful and rather romantic, and, you know, unless you're going to cut away to the old scene of the crashing waves on the beach or the train
going
entering
the tunnel,
into the
right.
tunnel, I don't know what you do. Yeah. Well, no, I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm, okay. Jonathan Pryce is my guest, and he's now starring in My Fair Lady in London. And he's also starring in the new movie Bride of the Wind about Alma Mahler. He plays Gustav Mahler. Your breakthrough musical, which was also the musical that a lot of people in the States were introduced to you through, was Miss Saigon, mm-hmm. In which you played a pimp selling girls on the street. And you played the role in London, then took the role to the States. When you took to the role to the States, it was a big controversy because Asian American actors protested that an Asian American should have the role because it's a Vietnamese role, half Vietnamese, half French. And Actors Equity agreed, so there was a protest against you getting the role. You almost weren't allowed to play it. I'm wondering if you ever wanted to give up. I mean, you know, let's face it, there's so few roles for Asian American actors, and particularly when Miss Saigon came out, color colorblind casting hadn't progressed to even the point that it is today.
Well, I think the issue of Miss Saigon promoted and helped the issue of colorblind casting. It was, I mean, it works both ways in every way. You can't, you know, if you demand that people of any role should, any ethnic background should be able to play any role, then that covers, you know, black, white, whatever. And it, I mean, there were very positive things came out of those arguments. And one was that people were made aware that there was a problem and that minority actors weren't being seen for the roles they should be seen, and that very positive things came out of the Miss Saigon issue.
Did it make you more sensitive to colorblind casting?
I'd always been sensitive to colorblind casting. I'd worked in multiracial companies in Liverpool, Nottingham, and Stratford, so it wasn't a problem for me. The company in London, the Miss Saigon company, was a multiracial cast. There were people of all nationalities playing all kinds of roles. It wasn't a Caucasian cast, you know. It was, if there was a frustration, it was at the time, it was that our case wasn't being understood or represented properly. And so I never really felt a lot of frustration of it because I knew the validity of our case, really.
Well, why don't we hear a song from the cast recording of Miss Saigon? And this is you singing in your role as a pimp. The song is called What a Waste, and you're selling girls in the song. Let's hear it.
What a waste to pay for my keep, from rounding up sheep to fleece here in Bangkok. I'm disgraced, I can't get ahead. There's nothing as dead as peace here in Bangkok. Come on, guys, check my girls, huh? 10 cents an hour and I stand all day. You like what you see, huh? Yeah. I could sell Kim for 10 times my pay. Guys, here, guys. If you're looking for fun, original sin, if you want to put out, then you gotta come in. Isn't Bangkok really neat?
I got girls.
The things they're selling on the street.
Girls.
Fresh dog, if that's what you'd enjoy.
Worth the price.
A girl, or if you want a boy.
Come to me.
Hey, get out of it, will ya?
First drink is free.
Oh, don't be a lump. You can hump for a small extra fee.
Jonathan Pryce, words like slimy and repellent were used to describe your character in this musical. It must have been an interesting character to play.
It was, yes, yeah. As I'd never done anything like this before, and a completely sung-through role was very exciting and challenging to do.
Let me contrast your role of the aggressive pimp to a role that you played in David Mamet's film adaptation of his play Glengarry Glen Ross. And this is a play about salesmen who are sharks. They're very smarmy, fast talkers. They sell real estate that probably isn't worth a dime, but they're selling it for a lot of money to people who aren't smart enough to kind of pick up on the scam. And you're one of those unsuspecting people. You've bought some land from Al Pacino. But in this scene, you've come in to say that you've spoken to your wife and she insists that you back out of the deal. Of course, Al Pacino has no intention of letting you back out of the deal. So here's Pacino trying to get away from you.
I'll call you this evening. Jim, I'm sorry. I had to come all the way in. I'm sorry. Monday lunch.
We really have to go.
All right, Monday.
She called the consumer, the attorney, I don't know, the attorney general. They said we have 3 days.
Who'd she call?
The attorney, it was some consumer office.
Why'd she do that, Jim?
I don't know. No, but they said we have 3 days. They said we got 3 days, yeah.
3 days?
To, you know.
No, I don't know. Tell me.
Well, to change our minds.
Of course you have. 3 days.
Well, so we can't talk Monday.
Monday? You saw my book. Jim. Jim. I can't. You saw my book. I can't.
Yeah, but we have to before Monday to get our money back.
3 business days, they mean. 3 business days.
Yeah, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
I don't understand.
That's what they are, the 3 business days. Look, if we wait till Monday, my time limit runs out.
You don't count Saturday.
I'm not.
I'm saying, you don't include Saturday in 3 days. It's not a business day.
I am not counting it. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, so it would have elapsed.
What would have elapsed?
If we wait till Monday, it would have elapsed.
When did you write the check?
Yesterday.
What was yesterday?
Tuesday.
And when was that check cashed?
I don't know.
Well, what was the earliest that it could have been cashed?
I don't know.
Today? Today? Which, in any case, it was not, as there was something on the agreement I wanted to go over with you, in any case.
It wasn't cashed.
I just phoned downtown. It's on their desk.
That's Jonathan Pryce and Al Pacino in a scene from David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross. Jonathan Pryce, what's it like to be the person who is so afraid and unassertive that he can barely speak in a movie that's just populated with fast talkers?
It's quite a relief, really. The irony is I filmed that during the day while I was doing Miss Saigon, so at night I was playing the sleazy pimp and the fast-talking hustler, and during the day being which is just about what I had enough energy to do, be the wimp who was trying to slide out of things, yeah.
That's funny.
We had a good time with great actors, and we rehearsed it as if it were a stage play. We rehearsed at length for a couple of weeks or so. It was good.
My guest is actor Jonathan Pryce. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Pryce. He's starring in the London revival of My Fair Lady, and he plays composer and conductor Gustav Mahler in the new film Bride of the Wind. Let's talk about your life a little bit. You grew up in Wales. Would you describe the area that you're from?
It was quite a thriving semi-industrial area of North Wales. There were the hills where the farmers lived and the plateau where I lived, and then there was the down on the coast and in the valleys where the industry was centred, and it's a lot of coal mines, and now it's a very depressed area, like much of Wales, because industry has moved out, the coal mines have closed down. It's now very beautiful and green, but it's because nothing happens there.
Your parents ran a grocery store?
Mm-hmm, yeah. My father was originally a coal miner, and then he met my mother, and they opened a small grocery shop in a village.
Did you have to work in the store?
I didn't have to. I did when my father was older and he was ill, and I used to help him out a little. We used to go out on the... he drove a mobile shop, a van that you sold groceries from the back of the van around the housing estates and things. So I went out on that and made a few deliveries with him and occasionally worked in the shop, yeah.
Did doing that expose you to different types of people that maybe you were able to draw on later for characterizations?
I don't remember. I remember all the characters, and there were a lot of characters at the time who came into the shop. They were people from the kind of previous generation. They seem from another... When I think back on them now, they were very much... another world. It was the pre-war and immediate post-war world of the women who worked in the textile mills and the paper mills that were near the shop. It was a very poor area, so there was lots of characters, I remember. Most of them owed us money. That's what I remember most.
They owed you money, did you say?
Yeah, so my father survived once the supermarkets opened in the town. He survived on giving credit to all the people who'd spent their money at the supermarkets, and then they needed groceries towards the end of the week, which they would get on credit, you know, from my father. And then you'd have to go and collect the money from them.
Did you have to do that, to go and collect the money?
Yeah, yeah. I still remember those people who still owe us money, so...
That's an awful position to be in, though, isn't it?
Oh, it was horrible. It wasn't a great time. No, not for my father, anyway. He was very popular... man in the village prior to this, and you know, he had a very nice life, and then I don't know if it means anything to you, but the advent of supermarkets and large scale, you know, stores, it killed off a lot of the small businesses, and it certainly ruined my father's way of life.
Your father was also, I think, attacked in the store, and that resulted in a stroke, and he died, I think, just a couple of years after that.
Mm-hmm.
How old were you at the time of the attack?
I was in my late 20s. I was when he was attacked initially, I was directing in the theatre in Liverpool, which was not very far away from where we lived. And he died, as you say, about 2 years later, actually while I was in New York doing Comedians. He died. That informed... I mean, I managed to work out a lot of things about my father through various plays that I did, especially Comedians, which was about ostensibly a relationship between a young man and an older teacher. It was the kind of father-son relationship that I was never really capable of and never was able to, because while we were doing it and my father saw it, that's when he had the stroke and lost his... we never spoke again. He lost his power of speech. But it informed all kinds of things. The way I played Hamlet, for instance, was informed by my feelings about my father. And
how?
Well, it was mainly to do with the portrayal of the ghost of your father. And we... We wanted to find a way of interpreting the ghost, the appearance of the father, as shocking as it to a modern audience as it would have been when it was originally performed. This was 1980. The Exorcist was still strong in people's minds, and I explored ways of depicting possession and people who spoke in tongues. And I thought I'd seen my father after he died. A couple of times he appeared to me, and it was, I think, nothing more than wish fulfillment, that desire to see someone who was gone, and it was impossible. And I sort of moulded this to Hamlet, that he was so racked with guilt, not doing anything to avenge his father's death, which is what I did at the time my father died, you know, albeit through a stroke. It was initiated by a violent act. And I'd felt no sense of that I wanted to revenge his death. Hamlet didn't revenge his father's death, and Hamlet, racked with guilt about this, conjured up the image of his father who then told him how he died. And this was in a fit of possession, and the voice of the father came from within me. So I played the ghost, very like Linda Blair in The Exorcist, speaking in this strange belly voice, possessed by the ghost of your father.
You said that when your father was killed, you had no interest in trying to avenge his death.
Well, I wouldn't say it was no interest, but it was something I sublimated within myself. My sisters felt very angry, and other people in the community felt very angry and wanted to deal violently with the young man who'd done it. But I suppose I was a little more sanguine about it at the time and felt helpless and nothing I could really do about it.
So there was someone who stood trial for the attack?
Yes, oh yes, yeah. He was 16, and so he received a kind of youth custody sentence for about 6 months.
Now, what happens to you psychologically when you feel you're actually like working through one of the most emotionally potent experiences of your life, you know, that you're working through that in this play?
Well, you save money on therapy, I think. It becomes almost a celebration of that aspect of your life and the aspect, you know, how I felt about my father. And it was a very positive way of dealing with things. I didn't do it in order to deal positively with it or thought of it at the time as therapy. But in retrospect, it was the best thing I could have done.
I'm thinking, though, that if a director doesn't like what you're doing, it would be particularly difficult and particularly painful to change, because you're not only playing Hamlet, you're acting out your deepest feelings about your father. Well, so you have so much personally on the line there.
Yeah, well, the director was Richard Eyre, who was a personal friend. I worked with him for quite a number of productions, worked in his company at Nottingham for a year or so. He knew me very well, and it was this was something we worked out together. I didn't go to him and say, this is how I want to approach Hamlet. It was something that evolved in discussions prior to rehearsals and during rehearsals. And, you know, if it hadn't been valid, neither of us would have wished to have pursued it, but it seemed very right at the time.
My guest is actor Jonathan Pryce. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Pryce. He plays Gustav Mahler in the new film Bride of the Wind. At the same time that you're starring in the new movie Bride of the Wind, you're starring in London in a West End production of My Fair Lady, mm-hmm. as Professor Henry Higgins. Just for any of our listeners who aren't familiar with the story of My Fair Lady, Professor Henry Higgins decides to take a poor woman selling flowers in the street and make her into a proper lady. And the way he goes about this is to, like, you know, not only train her in etiquette, but to teach her to speak proper English and, you know, to lose her Cockney accent. And, of course, The Rain in Spain Falls Mainly on the Plain is the song in which he teaches her how to speak proper English. I'm wondering what kind of proper accent you use, you know, because Henry Higgins has to speak the most proper English. Is that an English that's natural to you, or are you speaking a different English than you usually
speak?
Well,
I'm Welsh, so my basic accent is, it was, before I went to drama school, was I had a Welsh accent, and I've learned how to speak English, as it were. But my version of received pronunciation, RP, as it's called here, according to Patsy Rodenberg, who is the voice coach and the voice expert at the National Theatre, where we're doing the play, she's the recording she's listened to of the time, which is the early 1900s. My accent is pretty much how they spoke. It's not the accent I'm talking with now. It's a little more proper. But it's not what people think good English is, which came about through the 20s and 30s, that very clipped sort of Noel Coward version of English. It's a much more straightforward version. Vowel sounds are correct. I don't, in my natural speaking voice, all the time have correct vowel sounds, because whereas English people say grass, I say grass. And if people say bath, I say bath. And that's much to the amusement of my children, who think I speak strangely at times, because they've been brought up in England.
Patsy Rodenberg, the speech and dialect expert who you mentioned, has been a guest on our show, and we're great admirers of her. What advice did she give you?
She said, "You're doing just fine."
No, I guess that's the best advice of all.
I went to her, actually, because she hadn't said anything to me, and I said, "Patsy, is it okay what I'm doing?" She said, "No, it's perfect." So I didn't push it. That was fine for me.
Okay. Yeah. So tonight you're performing in My Fair Lady on the West End.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to take care of yourself in a different way when you've got nightly performances?
Yeah, you do. I don't do... this is the most talking I'll do of a day. I don't do very much. The show is quite long. It's 3.25 hours. So I'm kind of out of my dressing room at 11:15 at night, and there ain't a lot I want to do then. I get home, everyone's gone to bed, so I'm usually... I sit up reading until about 2 in the morning.
What are you reading?
Newspapers. I spent hours reading the newspaper. We've got the general election this week, so there's acres of political reporting to do. It's quite amusing at the moment. But we have the vote on Thursday. We have a different system to you. I don't know if you know, because when our voting system, whoever gets the most votes becomes prime minister.
Right.
So I don't know. Call us old fashioned. There you go.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Jonathan Pryce recorded earlier this week. He plays composer and conductor Gustav Mahler in the new film Bride of the Wind. Pryce is also starring in the London revival of My Fair Lady,